Ever heard of the phrase, the Internet of Things? And you might say to yourself, doesn't that sound like what it already is? Kind of. Most of the data going online today is input by humans, but what if there was a way to get information from inanimate objects? Imagine the accuracy of inventory, the ease of finding lost items. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we're joined by our computer guys to discuss just that, as well as the culture of makers, people who are using technology, invention, and entrepreneurship to create. From an air-quality egg to a plastic square you can program to tell if your laundry is done or not, or when someone's at your door. Technology meets the real world on Central Standard, following this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. With all objects in the world equipped with identifying devices, daily life on Earth will undergo a transformation, even more so than we are already transformed. The concept of the Internet of Things came from British technologist Kevin Ashton, who proposed connecting the physical world to a global network via pervasive sensors on everyday objects. This is Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Today, we explore that subject, the Internet of Things, with your computer guys, George Costello, an independent Mac consultant, and Thomas O'Brien of Ideology. Welcome back once again, gentlemen.
Thank you.
What is the Internet of Things, and how does it work?
Well, it's a good question, and the Internet itself, okay, is a network of computers. So it's physically connected, generally, computers by either fiber optic cables or copper or whatever it might be. And the nodes on the Internet are servers. And servers serve up the information that we look at on the World Wide Web or, you know, however we interact with it. Servers would be things on the Internet. And then your computer, when you connect to the Internet, there's a thing. And then this concept extends that quite a bit further to other things that are more sensor-like things. For instance, temperature gauge, or just something as simple as an accelerometer that can tell when something moves or not. Alarm systems that are connected to the Internet are part of the Internet of Things. When you are watching your youngster at home over a webcam while you're at work, or checking on your dog at doggy daycare, you're participating in the Internet of Things.
But even in the concept of the Internet of Things, we're talking about stuff outside of technological application, such as rocks, trash cans, signposts, taxi cabs, through radio frequency identification. That's the most prominent application today.
There's several.
For that.
RFID, radio frequency, is one, because these are little devices that attach to anything and they don't consume any power whatsoever until a detector comes by. And then it says, the detector's sending out a signal that says, are you there? Is somebody there? Is somebody there? And if it happens to pass this little rice grain-sized RFID device, it gets enough energy from that signal to say, yes, I'm here and here's my number. And then all of a sudden you've counted that item.
What types of physical objects can RFID devices be attached to and have an efficacy in being detected?
Well, right now you see it in department stores. You know, it helps prevent shoplifting. I think everybody's walked into a store that's had those vertical detectors by the door when you walk in and out. So if you happen to purchase something with an RFID in it, even if they try to disable it, sometimes it'll set off an alarm. That's happened to me. So, you know, they're already in use.
Is that your story, or is that what happened to you?
That's what he said in court.
Yeah.
Well, you know, also the library. In Johnson County Library, right. You don't check out your book with a barcode anymore. You just slide it across a detector. And that's using near-field communication, which is RFID shrunk down to a very short distance.
And the RFID that we're talking about would expand the ranges of detection.
Right. Generally, RFID is tens of feet whereas our NFC is a couple of inches.
It's natural, George and Tom, that this would be a good fit for businesses with inventory considerations. How would such technology, the Internet of Things, work for a business?
You know, logistics, trucking companies, any business, that they already use it. They've been doing it for a long time. GPS, of course, is a big contributor to the Internet of Things because it helps you locate things. So if you took a little tiny GPS device and attach it to the truck, then it can communicate with the home office and they know exactly where they are. That is really important for things like fuel savings and scheduling and that sort of thing. Farmers, same deal. Soil moisture testing, using it to plant via GPS, they can do that with that's how they participate in the Internet of Things.
How does this graduate to the consumer world?
Well, how about your Prius? you can now, if you have the 2012 Prius, I think, is interconnects your iPhone or your Android phone with its navigation system.
Yeah, it uses the phone as an internet connection.
Right, right. And so, it gives you a chance to look at the weather radar on the little screen on your Prius as opposed to distracting yourself by holding up the phone while you're driving.
Talk about the concept of the Internet of Things off the web.
Mm-hmm.
Make the distinction.
Well, the web, as we know, is a collection of it's like a huge publishing system. That's how we interact with the Internet most of the time. We're looking at documents, basically, whether it's a newspaper or, Facebook. However, a lot of things are connected to the Internet that never show up on the web.
And what are some examples of some
things? It's not sinister at all. Routers, for example. You know, the devices, the plumbing of the Internet never shows up on the web. There are a lot of sensory devices that don't need to have a web page that exposes them to public or private view. These are things that are kind of sent across the Internet that are dark, I guess, unseeable by normal people.
So by that rationale, does the Internet of Things culture that we will be seeing in the coming years, does that take some activity off the web?
Well, no, it probably is going to add more. That's the American way, you know, more is better.
Well, you'll control your things using a web page probably. When it gets to the consumer or just to the you and I type people, how we might use that, then we're going to use it with a web connection. But the thing is that it'll operate without having the web page running at all.
You know, it wouldn't be out of the question for computer manufacturers, for example, to build in a device that constantly streams information back to the mothership and basically gives them a readout on, you know, how things are. It'd be wonderful for tech support, warranty stuff, and so on.
So we could see radio frequency identification being built in.
You wouldn't even need that.
A motherboard?
Well,
how does that technology work?
Well, you've already got computers are already connected to the Internet. So anything that already has a connection, it's just a matter of adding a little circuitry. RFIDs are more like add-on devices to something that's inanimate, typically a package of food, a T-shirt, or something like that.
Here's what really set me off on this over the last couple of months. The fact that right now you can go out and buy a very low-power Wi-Fi module, okay, for not that much money, $50. It consumes very little power, so it will run on a couple of AA batteries for months. When you think about it, it's very small, it's extremely portable, and it's very low power. It can be attached to anything. That's how that thing, whatever it's attached to, can communicate with the Internet, is by Wi-Fi. So it may use 802.11b, which gives it about a 300-foot range, and then it lets and then you don't have to be physically wired to the net.
What are some examples of how this works with everyday life?
Like, the example I was thinking about earlier, and it's not necessarily every day to anybody, but we have a client that has refrigerator that they need to monitor the temperature on. And so they have a device that simply checks the temperature on that refrigerator every 15 seconds or something like that. If it gets out of range, it sends an email and lets us know.
We're talking about the Internet of Things today with the computer guys George Costello, an independent Mac consultant, and Thomas O'Brien, an IT consultant with Ideology. Here's a clip from a video explaining how the Internet of Things could play out in an average day, kind of like that old cartoon, The Jetsons, only for real. Let's check it out.
But the ideal day, I guess, would be that I wake up in the morning and my alarm clock went off at the right time because it had looked in my diary to know when my first meeting was and had backtracked which ferry I need to get and therefore what time I need to get up. The bathroom heater would have been on for half an hour before that time to make the bathroom nice and warm. And I'd know that the temperature had been freezing overnight and therefore that my ice was going to need to be scraped off my car, so I need to leave the house 5 minutes earlier. And then I'd be getting a notification, perhaps an audio announcement in my car as I drive to the ferry saying, oh, the ferries are running 5 minutes late, so you know, no need to rush, just take your time. All that stuff is being handled by autonomic systems of little agents looking out on my behalf for the things it knows I want to do, you know, just making me aware of what's going on so that I can plan my day accordingly.
That's a clip explaining the concept of the Internet of Things. All systems are go at all times on any given day. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming on KCUR.org live. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. We're talking about the rise of a physical Internet through the use of radio frequency identification chips and other technologies. This is known as the Internet of Things. Our guests are the computer guys, George Costello, an independent Mac consultant, and Thomas O'Brien of Ideology. Kansas City, what types of physical objects would you like to see tagged for use on the Internet? Or do you think the Internet of Things is perhaps a step gone too far? Join the conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. When I hear this clip on how the Internet of Things is deployed for use in the daily life, I wonder, wouldn't you just on any given day want to shut this off like an alarm clock?
Yeah, you might. And then, you know, you miss the ferry for sure that way.
No, I was listening to that clip, and for some reason, you know what popped into my mind was the concept of a sort of an electronic nanny that was running your life, and you don't think anymore. And that reminded me of that Macintosh commercial 1984, where there's a room full of mindless automatons, you know, who don't think anymore.
And that's a slippery slope we'll be getting into. Speaking of not thinking, what do you guys think of the Internet of Things, and what ways would it help you enhance your life? George?
The problem with that question is that we don't know what the future is going to hold, and somebody's going to come up with something that's going to be just a killer idea, but we don't know what it is right now.
But for now, maybe you're thinking taxi cabs or train notifications or ferries, like this guy says.
Maybe. Probably, you know, for the typical homeowner, maybe some sort of external sensor that kicks on lights if there's activity outside or a door is opened or something like that. But that sort of already exists. Hard to say.
Tom, how would you use it?
It already exists, but this is maybe a refinement because it lets those things communicate with you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of people that are really interested in home automation because of the partly because of the gadget factor. And there's no question that this has a gadget factor that appeals to people that like gadgets. And I have to say that I'm one of them. But
yes, you are.
At the same time, there are very practical uses for it, even just in terms, and we've talked about things like this before, medical monitoring. You know, somebody's not particularly healthy. Their doctor can communicate, you know, and see what their vitals are like with, you know, the minimum of interference. Now somebody has to go to your house, knock on your door, get it answered, walk in, you know, put their stuff down, pull out the blood pressure cuff, you know, do the whole thing. Now, that's not saying that that's not what they would want to do in the future, but if your vitals could be taken without that physical call, it could improve your health.
So it'd sort of be like wearing an ankle bracelet if you were on probation.
So always two ways to look at these things.
And that's very appealing. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Kansas City, we want to know What types of physical objects would you like to see tagged for use on the internet for your daily lives, or do you think it's akin to wearing a probation monitoring bracelet? Do you think the Internet of Things concept, chips on rocks and trash cans and on posters in department store windows, for instance, is the Internet of Things a step taken too far? You can join the conversation also at centralstandard@kcur.org. Now, proponents of this Internet of Things doctrine, such as MIT Media Lab Director Joichi Ito, says this gives us the opportunity to learn from nature. What do you think of that assertion? Speaking of attaching the internet to a rock, what do you think of that assertion?
Well, we only know what we're able to get. We're big data. Humans love data, especially scientists and technologists. But when you think about it, data really does inform us and allows us to aggregate it, analyze it, look at it in a lot of different ways. The more data we have about our physical world, maybe the better that we can understand it. If you want to see what is happening in an ecosystem and you're able to measure things at a very micro level, even when you're not there, by means of these little devices, then that's going to give you a better understanding of what's really happening in nature so that you can either manage it or leave it alone.
We got Chris in Kansas City. Welcome to Central Standard, Chris.
Yes, I just have a quick question, wondering about kind of, you mentioned earlier about the low-power Wi-Fi devices, which just takes a AA battery or a couple of them, and wondering about, for kind of not saying car theft, but you could put one in your own car in your own driveway, and you could be connected via the Wi-Fi in your house, if that would work, and to see if your car was leaving overnight or give an alert.
Sure. Actually, there's a device that's coming out in about a month. It's called Twine, and it's 2.5 inches square, about a quarter of an inch thick. It has a Wi-Fi transmitter in it, an accelerometer, and a thermometer. The accelerometer would be what would tell you that your car is moving, and then the Wi-Fi would report back so that you would be alerted if that happened. So it's about a month away.
What devices will enable you to centrally understand and be able to delineate all of these updates and all of this communication? It has to come somewhere. Does it come to a watch? Does it come to a mobile handset? Do you leave your laptop open? Do you leave it on your TV? What's the most likely centralized point for the Internet of Things?
I'd say it's probably going to be a smartphone. That would be my guess, simply because it's the most portable device. On a slightly different subject, I was thinking about this over the weekend, and it occurred to me that why don't we use this technology for children? I mean, at any given time, there are kids that are missing, you know, right now. You know, there's people that have disappeared and been gone and so on. Why couldn't we use this in some fashion? I don't know that you'd want to necessarily put a chip in your kid the way you put a chip in a dog, you know, to determine where they're from. But if we had some ability to track children, particularly with GPS, I mean, we ought to be able to find them in a nanosecond.
Well, that technology has started with issuing children's cell phone to children, not children to cell phones, but
right.
Cell phones to children.
Yeah, but if somebody
at a younger age,
if somebody were to kidnap, you know, a kid, I mean, something like a cell phone would be obvious. You could take it away from them and throw it away or whatever. You'd need something that was a little more stealthy.
There are some who have advocated the fact that, or they've had the opinion that the crime level is decreasing because of the pervasiveness of our ability to report and notice crime.
I guess it also means that with the proliferation of electronic devices, that we're going to get a better class of criminal in the future. You know, they're going to need to be able to hack.
And that's certainly something that we'll be addressing in this hour as we talk about the Internet of Things. Even the Internet of Things can be hacked.
Right.
Chris in Overland Park, welcome to Central Standard. Chris?
Hi.
How you doing?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Well, my question, I love the show, very interesting subject. My question is, a lot of social networking sites right now are selling our information to direct marketers, and it seems to be just a better way. The more information that we can gather on the Internet seems to be a better way for corporations to reach consumers directly. Is this this technology could possibly change that and put the power in the hands of the consumers? The RFID chips and the Internet of Things could be how we track our local food, how we monitor our, you know, our biosphere, check ocean levels for pollution, and perhaps give us feedback on where our food is coming from, and then put the, you know, is it possible that this technology could put the consumer in power again?
Is it possible?
Yeah, and that's really one of the real exciting things. I think Chris really put his, you know, hit the nail on the head, because I was struggling to think of ways to describe the utility of the Internet of Things without kind of going into Jetsons territory or alerting people, you know, who are concerned, rightly so, about matters of privacy and that sort of thing. But if you turn it on its head, like Chris just did, you've got a situation where you go to a store and you look at an apple. You might be able to determine if there's a RFID chip on that apple exactly when it was picked and where it came from. That may let you buy that apple instead of one that isn't so good.
Yeah, I think that's down the road a piece, because there you're dealing with a subject of freshness, kind of hard to determine, you know, in the world that we live in now, what the right rates of deterioration would be for lettuce as opposed to a carrot. I think we're going to see this applied in things that are a little more mechanical.
Is it also a question of an interest level as well? Do you want to know that your chicken's coming from the farm and what time it'll be at the store? Do you have time to check that?
There are people that do care about that, but I think they're called vegetarians.
No, there's a growing movement of people who are interested in local food, and certainly that's you know, that would be a way to double check that. But I thought the concept of Chris's question was a good one.
We have a caller there who emails in us, actually a listener. He says he's curious as to how these electronic sensor devices would stand up to an X-class solar mass injection like the solar superstorm in 1859 that causes fires to break out at telegraph offices across the country during that natural disaster at that time.
Imagine yourself as a telegraph operator back then. Whew, that would give you hot fingers for sure. Yeah, those things, you're going to fry some of it. Yeah. No question about it.
The answer really is we don't know.
Yeah. The answer is you'll fry some of it.
Yeah. Well, back to some of the stuff we do know. We have another great explanation that we found on the web from Dr. Laura Srivastava at the European Commission of the Internet of Things. They actually had a conference on the Internet of Things in Budapest this time last year, in May of last year. She argues that the Internet of Things is simply an extension of our existing human senses. Let's check that out.
It will, if you will, help us better hear our planet. And like all electronic media upon which it's founded, it'll not only serve to extend a single human sense, but all five senses simultaneously. In McLuhan's words, the wheel is an extension of the foot, the book an extension of the eye, clothing an extension of the skin, electric circuitry an extension of the central nervous system. As such, we are, if you like, extroverting our human nervous system out into the world, creating a new sort of sensory planetary awareness and responsiveness. The body electric will speak to the planet electric. Now, all this is certainly like magic, the magic of things. But one must not forget that the Internet of Things, while bringing about many new opportunities and challenges, will also inherit the drawbacks of the current Internet. And it'll do so on an infinitely larger but more invisible scale.
That's from Dr. Laura Srivastava at the European Commission on the Internet of Things conference in Budapest, Hungary in May of last year, making some interesting points about the advantages of the Internet of Things and drawback of the Internet of Things. What are the ethical thresholds to consider here when you're essentially talking about tagging any and everything? What are those drawbacks?
Well, they're somewhat obvious, I think. You know, it's clearly an issue, especially in our country, of the individual rights of a citizen to privacy. And I think that there's a huge conversation that's going to have to be had about that. Of course, we're already having it on a kind of daily basis in this country.
You know, Kansas City, the city of Kansas City, had flood sensors installed on, I believe it was Brush Creek and different places that would track the level of the waters. And I distinctly remember that not so long ago, might have been a year or so ago, when we had some flash flooding, it turned out that the sensors didn't work. Now, let's look ahead to the future where we have these sensors spread out everywhere. Perhaps, something like, say, the city of New Orleans, which is under sea level, and you've got an array of sensors, and they don't work one time, and so you don't get the warning, and you get flooded, and now what does the law have to say about that? It's going to be interesting.
It's going to be interesting indeed. Our guests are the computer guys George Costello, an independent Mac consultant, and Thomas O'Brien of Ideology. We're talking about billions of objects connected to the Internet for use by billions of people. The Internet of Things is our subject today. When we return, we'll have the technology lightning round, plus more discussions on the pluses and minuses of such a vast global network of machine and nature in the person and entity of the Internet of Things. Kansas City, do you think the Internet of Things is a step gone too far, or are you making and utilizing the web to enhance everyday objects in your life? Tell us what you're building in your garage at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You could also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. More Internet of Things when we return. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. As of 2008, the number of inanimate objects connected to the Internet had already exceeded the world population. And experts predict that by the year 2020, there will be more than 50 billion things, and we're talking things from animals to signposts to toasters, connected to the Internet and by extension, ready for use and sight.
And
sound and abuse on the web, as one of our guests says. So we now continue our discussion on the concept of the Internet of Things. Kansas City, are you utilizing the Internet to enhance your use of everyday objects? Tell us what you're building in your garage. Or do you think the concept of the Internet of Things is a step gone too far in our collective consciousness? Join the conversation, 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. And those guests chiming in our background are George Costello, an independent Mac consultant, and Thomas O'Brien of Ideology. What happens, Tom and George, when more things are communicating with one another than people are communicating with one another? What are the pros and cons here as we continue this discussion? And by the way, we have two videos about the Internet of Things that you can look at on kcur.org to explain that concept further. What are the pros and cons here, George?
Well, privacy is always going to be an issue, and it's a giant gray area. I've sort of come to the conclusion in my own head that the only way out of this whole privacy thing is that there's going to have to be some laws passed that basically gives the data that you generate as an individual, any data that arises from your activities, that you own it. By default, it's going to have to come to that. But the other side of it is that what we're going to see when that happens is in the famous end-user licensing agreement is there'll be a sort of an opt-out thing where they automatically have a right to license your data and so on. So we're going to have that struggle, I think, forever.
Lance writes in along that vein, at centralstandard@kcur.org, to share, and I quote, "The privacy concerns regarding radio frequency identification are astounding. For example, the RFID info contained within U.S. passports is concerning when you think about how anyone with a few hundred dollars worth of equipment could read it. I have the same concerns for credit cards containing the PayPass wireless feature."
He's right.
Tom?
No, I agree. There are concerns definitely about that. You know, the thing about RFID chips and the thing about what George was saying, both are things that we'll have to work through. But the if you right now you own your own activity, if you go to the Internet and decide you want to use a website, Facebook or whatever, you're signing away some of your rights to your own data in return for free use of that site. So in a sense, what we're going to need to really clarify is how you pay attention to what you're doing with your data because you really do. You need to make sure that you're aware of what you're giving away.
We have Andrew and KC. Andrew, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning, Central Standard. How are you?
Good morning.
I just wanted to share a story, I think, in reference to, I believe his name was Chris from Overland Park, about fresh food and RFID use. I used to work as a commercial fisherman in a co-op that voluntarily adopted RFID tags when you would catch a fish. Now, it wasn't networked, but through a number of sensors along the supply chain, in a mass aggregate, the fishery could keep track of how quickly fishermen were turning in their catch. And actually, it would go all the way to the end user. In the local grocery store in my hometown of Portland, you'd have a freezer filled with frozen tuna. And there's a video display monitor there, and you could put your piece of tuna out, scan it, and you could watch a video about the fisherman who caught your fish, the boat, and what date and the conditions when it was caught. I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
That's a cool app. Snack on your fish while you're watching how it was caught.
That yes. is so cool. But, you know, how many times do people go to the store and buy something, maybe some fish, something fresh that has a very quick spoilage rate? If you have more information about how old it is going to make you either eat it sooner Monday as opposed to Tuesday. It cuts down waste. We've got 7 billion people, and they all have to eat, I think, every day. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure all people eat every day. So, or that's the idea. So,
well,
seriously.
No, all people don't eat every day.
They
but
should.
Perhaps
they
should
be eating. That's right. So anything that we waste is certainly something that shouldn't happen.
What things do you believe should always have sensors in this new Internet of Things consciousness, and what things should never have sensors? Let's address that question.
What should never have a sensor? Oh, the list. Where would that list start? I think you should be able to turn sensors off. You know, we have I know I'm jumping the gun, but there's been the invention of wallpaper that blocks Wi-Fi signals. Certainly, you can have zones where there is no Wi-Fi or cellular coverage. I think that's kind of an area where we probably ought to take the wilderness and leave it alone. That's the definition of wilderness, and I think people do have to have ample opportunity to interact with nature without being interfered with.
George, what do you want to see never, ever having a sensor?
I don't know. I think part of the problem is when technology like this gets in the hands of bureaucrats who simply don't think it through. I mean, one of the problems with RFIDs and passports is if you're in a foreign country, let's say you're in a dangerous country, you're walking around in Afghanistan or someplace, and you got your passport in your pocket, I'm assuming that the U.S. is either the only country or one of just a handful that would have an RFID inside the passport. So if you're an enemy and you're walking around in a crowd in a market somewhere and you've got a reader, it's going to find the person that's carrying that passport, and you're going to automatically know, even if they look like a native, that they're not. You know, so there's some real danger in the use and application of this kind of data by big government, big companies, and the like.
And as one of our listeners, Lance, pointed out, this opens up a whole new niche for hackers and counterfeiters as well.
It does.
Ethan writes in, instead of an electronic nanny, couldn't this be the kind of technology at more of a butler freeing us from some of the drudgery and allowing us to focus on more important tasks? Newton was able to spend time thinking, Sir Isaac Newton that they're referring to, Byron writing and dreaming, and Shackleton exploring, partly because they didn't have to check if they had taken out the trash or not. Talk about that standpoint. Does this make us more dependent on the constant flow of information, even the esoteric trivial things?
There is an interesting kind of tension there, right? Something between how much the load it places on you versus how much it frees you for being able to do other things. I think in my experience, technology has freed me to be able to do more things that I would not have been able to do prior to that, just because I don't have to be physically present in order to get certain things done that I can be sort of in two places at once. I think that's extremely helpful, and it gives us the ability to manage our leisure time a little bit better. Now, I think on the other side, you might just say, well, we all have less and less leisure time. But it's true. We need time to think.
Let's talk about one of the broader applications of the Internet of Things, such as Cisco's project Planetary Skin, which Cisco says it would use billions of land and sea sensors to predict changes in the environment. What do you think about this? Is it a little presumptuous? Could it work? And what are the real-world applications here? Planetary skin.
That is a way to sell a lot of Cisco equipment, isn't
it? Yeah, isn't it, though?
That may be a little bit far-fetched. You know, we really already have those, but we don't have that sort of central control. All those scientists are out busy competing for grant money all the time to do a particular thing to look at some portion of the environment. The Cisco vision is to have something that's pervasive and widely spread. Of course, they're the biggest networking company in the world, so I think that's their point of view.
They have a proprietary interest, don't they, in that network.
What part of this enhances business opportunities and open up new markets, and what part of this actually helps our everyday life experience as human beings? It sounds mostly geared toward more efficient commerce.
Yeah, I think initially that's where you're going to see it used, and then it'll trickle down probably more into your personal and private life.
When when we discuss energy use in America and we want to free ourselves from foreign oil, we think, what can we do to reduce that reliance on imported oil? I'm getting someplace with this. Well, always the number one first thing that you do is conserve. You don't switch to natural gas overnight. You don't go to nuclear overnight. So what do? The immediate impact is to conserve the energy that you're using currently. Use it better. Use it more efficiently. Don't use as much. Same thing is here. The efficiencies gathered by being able to sense some of the things that we've been talking about and integrate them into a knowledge network are going to do exactly that. Once again, we have to feed a lot of people.
What role ultimately will this Internet of Things concept play in our use of devices as our phones get smarter and the cost of hardware goes down and the web becomes even more pervasive? What are we seeing looking forward? What's a forward-looking prognostication on this?
Well, I think what will happen is you're going to, if you fast forward 50, 60 years,
ooh,
people won't even know that they're using these things. I can see a future where technology is not even evident to anybody. There is no such thing as a smartphone or a TV set because it's so deeply embedded in our lives that we just don't even notice it.
All you need is pyramid hands and a Mr. Burns voice. Totally seamless. George, any thoughts?
No, not really. It's a slippery slope in some regards, and it's going to be wonderful in others.
George would say that I already went down the slope, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah,
okay. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. We've been talking about the Internet of Things. Our guests are computer guys George Costello, an independent Mac consultant, and Thomas O'Brien of Ideology. Now let's speed things up a bit.
It's time now for a technology news lightning round with Thomas O'Brien and George Costello.
The thunder has struck. The digital voice has spoken. Let's get into the lightning round, fellas. Now that Facebook has conducted a small test of charging users to promote their status updates, is it inevitable that some type of revenue model has to emerge here and that eventually Facebook is going to charge people?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Facebook, you know, they're going for their IPO this week, I think, or at least very soon.
Yeah.
So they need to convince investors that they can make money. Facebook can't grow that much more. I mean, they've got 900 billion user or million users.
Right.
So their growth rate in terms of users is going to continue to slow down. It may even sink at some point. But what really matters to investors is how much money can they make? And they're going to do it by advertising.
And they have a large valuation, but you have to think that perhaps that valuation will shrink quarter by quarter if they're not showing actual profits.
Right. And that would not make them happy or rich.
And a new privacy policy also in the works at Facebook. They're supposed to announce something later today in the form of a Q&A on the web about what types of data they're using and tell other people about you. How is the privacy thing going to play out?
The whole idea of open graph, Facebook calls their ability to analyze and understand the connections between people who use Facebook is called the social graph. Their ability to interconnect that with other websites and other things is called the open graph. And, you know, it's clear that this is a company that is data-driven.
And some people might want a skin graph with all this information out there. Right. Cloud storage and configurations getting cheaper, George. You can set them up for about $200. How does that work?
You just go buy a couple of devices. One in particular is called a Pogo Plug. And you can go to pogoplug.com and check it out. It's not very expensive. It plugs into your router on one end, and on the other end, you can plug in up to four external hard drives, and you set up an account with this company, and it basically allows you to log in and access your data from anywhere in the world.
And that's the benefit?
The benefit is that it's private. You know, you're not entrusting your data to some big nameless, faceless entity. There'd be some disadvantages to that, and there'd be some advantages. But you can set up your own private cloud for the price of the device and a hard drive.
Bing's market share, Microsoft's search engine, has risen above 30%. Meanwhile, Google's share of the search engine market is falling. What's up with that?
I thought this was really pretty interesting because Google is so pervasive that we just kind of – it's actually become a word that we use, you know, a verb. Let's Google this. But Bing has been making inroads. The two websites are not really comparable. If you go – people that go to Bing and search, they have about 15% of the market. People that go to Google and search, that's about 64% of the market. So it's still quite a difference. However, Bing sort of OEMs or resells its search technology to others, and that's what makes up that other 15%. So Microsoft has always been really good at business. And that's what they're doing. They've taken Bing and they've leveraged it into a true business.
And speaking of search, Yahoo CEO is quitting. And what could this mean for a search engine company that's in search of an identity?
Boy, how many CEOs have they had in the last 3 years? Too many. Yahoo's way down there in the percentage. I think they've got about 14% of search. So they're not something to be trifled with, but that's a company that's completely awash.
Yeah, but, you know, the smaller search companies are smaller because they don't have a platform to put their name in front of you. You know, Microsoft can put Bing into their OS, and Google is pervasive in a lot of web browsers and so forth as the default search engine. The little guys don't have that ability.
Where does that leave Yahoo, which seemingly has no platform other
Yahoo
than the web?
Yahoo seems to be searching for a new identity or something. I'm not sure exactly. But Yahoo has a lot of other things that they do well. And they just need to get some stability in that company.
Maybe they should maybe perhaps search on Bing or search on Google for a new business model.
Definitely another new CEO.
Yeah, right.
George, rumors of a smaller iPad and cheaper MacBook Air coming this fall?
We're still hearing the rumors.
Where are they coming from?
Well, you know, who knows? On the web, there's people that claim to know people who know people, and they either have access to information about parts that are being made overseas or they know somebody that works in Cupertino. In any event, you know, you get rumors about products that Apple is looking at, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to see the light of day. I think they'd be smart to bring out a smaller iPad.
Because, and why is that?
Well, because that's the stock in trade of Kindle and the Kindle Fire and some of these other smaller tablets. And Apple has such a domineering presence in the 10-inch tablet market that they ought to offer the same capability in a smaller size at a lower price point to sort of take over that market.
And speaking of Apple, Apple's Siri tells users that the Nokia Lumia 900 is the best smartphone ever. What's the deal with that?
Apparently, it's using some standard search technology or something. The guys that develop Siri, you know, they built in some stock answers to questions that they knew people were going to ask, like, Siri, what's the meaning of life, you know, or some other question that's really not answerable. I just find it amusing that Apple apparently overlooked this question, and Siri is using its search capabilities and so on to come up with an answer. It came up with Nokia in this case. So you can rest assured that that'll be fixed very soon.
We've been seeing those Siri commercials, and apparently Siri loves the Nokia Lumia 900. It's the best smartphone ever.
I wonder if
that's
tell
you over and over again.
I wonder if that's like a Google bombing. You remember they used to would Google bomb by doing lots of searches on one thing to raise
awareness. Yeah,
maybe that's what they've done is some Siri bombing.
Anti-Wi-Fi wallpaper, Tom.
Well, you know, it's got little particles of silver embedded in it so that it disrupts a Wi-Fi signal, but it won't mess with your cell phone.
And why would you want anti-Wi-Fi wallpaper?
Well, I was going to ask you that question, Javelin.
I don't know, for decorative purposes?
You know, you might just want a quiet room. I don't know.
Does it block out other signals coming from outside? Does it hinder your in-house connection? How does it work?
I think we're all familiar with going into a basement or into a big building with lots of steel and having a hard time getting a cell signal because we're a little further away from the cell tower and we're buried in all this concrete and steel. It's the same concept.
I'd be more curious about the design, whether you get unicorns or My Little Pony or pictures of Harry Houdini in those little shorts. I'd be interested in seeing what the wallpaper designs of this Wi-Fi actually
are. Yeah, let's hope it's not blank.
New info out on text messages declining. Do we know why?
Yes, we do know why, actually, and we are attributing it to the decline of text messaging by cell phone is being attributed to Facebook and other platforms that build messaging into their systems.
And are you expecting this to continue?
Well, yeah, it's going to continue, but it's a problem because text messaging is hugely profitable for the cellular companies, Sprint, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile. They make a lot of money on text messaging. So if they see that volume going down, they're going to either need to reverse the trend by making it more attractive
or cheaper,
but you know that kind of defeats the purpose, or they're going to have to find another revenue stream to keep things going.
Aero sued to stop streaming over-the-air content. Who is Aero? Why were they sued? What's happening here, Tom?
It's Aereo.
Aereo.
This is a New York City. This is a New York City only play. But I thought it was interesting. Aereo. You know how right now you can just get digital TV by on an antenna
over the air.
Over the air. You don't have to pay for it. You just put an antenna up, and bingo, you've got a few channels. Well, in New York City, same deal. There's about 20 stations that have these digital channels. However, because of all the buildings and whatnot, it's not always easy to get the over-the-air. So what Aereo is doing is redistributing that in a web stream so that you can be in your apartment in Manhattan, watch the TV show that you want that over-the-air for free. Well, the networks don't like that.
What does this case mean for over-the-air content litigation or streaming in the future?
Well, the broadcasters are saying that they want control over their content, that they need to exercise where it's consumed so that they can obviously make money.
Yeah, but Aereo is really not technically in violation of anything because for each subscriber that they acquire, they put up a little dime-sized antenna on, you know, some massive receptor board of some kind. So all they're doing technically is receiving the signal that the end user would have received and just directing it to him over a different path.
Which shows you how arcane things have gotten in the world of technology and the law.
Yeah. And speaking of arcane, Thomas, a story about a fireman generating heat. Tell us about that.
In Connecticut, a fireman went and got a medical test that required them to inject a tiny bit of radiation into his bloodstream. He was discharged by his doctor. He was driving home, and he got stopped by the state police for driving a radioactive vehicle. And it turns out that in Connecticut, part of their Homeland Security
equipment
is radiation detectors on patrol cars. And it is sensitive enough to detect the radiation the traces that he was dribbling about as he drove home.
Pretty amazing, really.
Pretty amazing, and now we know that they're tracking radiation as well.
That's exactly right.
Right.
Apple to replace Google Maps with C3 Tech in its iOS 6. What's up with that, George?
Just going to have a better map system. From the report so far, it's beautiful to look at. You know, it's like a 3D, sort of like a high-tech animated movie, I guess, would be the best analogy that I could offer up to people. It's just a sharper, clearer, niftier, better defined three-dimensional mapping system.
So you do see it making a run at Google Maps?
Yeah, but I mean, how many people's lives depend on Google Maps? I mean, you know, it's nice. It's a nice feature, but I don't think that it's something that's going to cause people necessarily to say, "Oh my God, I can't live without that." You know, so.
Well, if they add a GPS component, certainly,
sure,
that'd make it interesting.
Why not?
Anne in Westport wants to know what you expect or when you expect the iPhone 5.
You know, we're getting conflicting reports on that. Initially, somebody was saying that maybe this summer, maybe they would introduce it at Apple's developer conference, which is June the 11th. But lately, the rumors now are saying that most of the new products are going to come out around October. So but right now, it's looking like the smaller iPad and refreshes on some of the laptops and the iPhone 5 will all come in the fall. So we wait and see.
And speaking of which, iPhones are going to be available via some smaller U.S. handset carriers?
That's where some of the growth is going to come in the next year or two, is that it will trickle down from the big guys down into some of the smaller regional carriers so that those people can have access to the phone, and it'll keep Apple sales up.
A caller in KCK wants to rate our lightning round and know if there are any risks in using Skype. To close out here, Tom.
Oh, risks. I don't know what they mean by risks. You know, any time that you're going across the net, you're open to some extent. Skype has what? Any given moment, they have 7 or 8 million users any
online,
second,
yeah,
day or night. It's well used, but I wouldn't share my, espionage secrets over Skype.
Charles, don't show the private papers over Skype.
Right.
Is what we're hearing.
Right.
Don't do
that.
Anything that's private over the internet. Period.
The computer guys are George Costello, an independent Mac consultant, and Thomas O'Brien, an IT consultant with Ideology. Thank you once again for coming and shedding light on us.
Thank you.
Tech universe. And tune in tomorrow when we learn how pets help us heal. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch, and apparently the up-to-date music is on early. Up-to-date is next and examines the possibility of a name change for UMKC to the University of Kansas City. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.